The Pac-12 started out bowl season right with a win. What does success look like for the conference? And why you should root for every Pac-12 team, even if it's your rival? Which players did enough to enter the NFL draft? And what's up with the fight for assistant coaches in the conference? And National Signing Day surprises, who won, who lost? I'm George Reister with Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Ralph, man, the Pac-12 started out bowl season, right? Washington got the W. And I posted on Twitter that fans of Pac-12 schools, doesn't matter whether you're Washington, Oregon, Cal, Arizona, whatever, whoever you are a fan of, that you should root for every team in the conference to be successful, because it makes the entire conference look good, because you're playing non-conference games. And people always say, oh, the Pac-12 can't win non-conference games, all of this. But then all my replies were, no, I'll never do it. It's awful. It's stupid. And I'm like, do you see what the SEC does? They, even if their rival wins, they pump themselves up. They put themselves on a pedestal. I'm like, why aren't Pac-12 fans savvy enough or willing to do this?
All right, so I don't get this. Let's just get one thing straight and out in the open right away. A win in any bowl game from one of your conference mates means more money for you, correct? Your school correct. Gets paid more money if people from your conference win games. I mean, the fans don't see that money. It's not like that goes directly into their pocket. But if you're a fan of a program, any help for that program is good. These games don't affect you. I don't care if you're an Oregon fan. It doesn't affect you in the slightest to see University of Washington in a 7-5 season go out and take it to Boise State. What, are they going to have bragging rights? They went 7-5. Who cares? Root for them because it lines your pockets, period. This whole thing doesn't make any sense to me. It reminds me of that the prayer of the selfish child from the Shel Silverstein poem from A Light in the Attic. The now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my toys will break so none of the other kids can use them. Amen. That's what it reminds me of. Like, why would you care? You're gone. Why would you care who's playing with your toys? Like, this does not affect anybody in the slightest. And the thing that I don't get is that people who root against, like, say you root against Washington, they lose to Boise State, some of the other conference mates all lose their bowl games, then you want to complain and blame Larry Scott for the poor performance of the teams in bowl games. Like, no, just root for the teams, and then when they win, you collect the cash and then hope that your school does something positive with that extra money. I get and I understand people who don't buy into the back-to-pack philosophy early in the season. Like, I will entertain those arguments. What I don't understand is when it comes to bowl season, when you have absolutely no skin in the game whatsoever, except for the fact that you actually get extra money if they win. Like, I will never understand not just saying, like, yeah, well, I hope the best thing for my school is the outcome. Like, that's cutting off your nose to spite your face. It makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's just blame Larry Scott for the money. Like, yes, he has done some things that he's a saboteur at times. However, don't then go and sabotage yourself. Take your best. Do what's in your own school's best interest, which is have more money. That means more resources for recruiting. And I don't even understand it in non-conference games early in the season. If you're a Washington fan, you should have been rooting for Oregon versus Auburn, because if your team was as good as you thought it was going to be with Jacob Eason, Chris Peterson, you know, Jimmy Lake, this defense, all of this, if it was as good as you thought it was going to be, Why wouldn't you want Oregon to beat Auburn and then turn around and beat Oregon?
Right. So your win means more. Exactly. It's very simple. It's a very simple math. And so, like I said, I'll entertain those arguments. It doesn't mean that I buy into them. But when it comes to bowl games and it actually affects your bottom line, it's stupid. You're punishing yourself in order to get some dopamine-infused satisfaction in a game that doesn't matter from a team that is beneath yours. Let's say that you're an Oregon fan, because that's what a lot of the comments were. I'll never root for Washington. I'll never root for Washington. You know what the biggest insult of all is? Remember Don Draper boarding that elevator, turning to the side and saying, "I don't think of you at all"?
Yeah.
That's the biggest insult in the
world.
Correct. Don't watch the bowl game.
Yep.
Don't care about the outcome. But when somebody tells you Washington beat the living hell out of Boise State, then that's the first time you can think about it. And you can be like, "Oh, good. More money for me."
Exactly.
Like, be selfish. Ayn Rand style.
Yeah. Yeah. Be like, "Oh, thank you. Thank you for helping our recruiting budget, Washington. We will thank you for helping us if we sign the rest of our recruits be the number one team in the Pac-12. We appreciate you. Thank you so much for doing your part." And in reality, these bowl games, even though that they're meaningless games, they do actually affect preseason rankings for next year and how the perception is of the conference, because the Pac-12 has a lot of repairing to do. Like, it needs to win games against name brand teams just to get the type of, you know, because people need to look at you and say, "Oh, okay. That's cool." I mean, look at the Boise State brand. When Boise State beat Florida State, nobody was surprised, because they beat so many good teams that you're like, "Oh, well, yeah, Boise is a pretty good team." But then when Washington, and they have enough cachet that when Washington wins, they're like, "Oh, okay, Washington, that was a solid win." And so And then when you're looking forward to your team winning a national championship or the possibility of getting in the college football playoff, you want to make sure that the teams that you are playing are as pumped up and inflated as possible. The way you be the one to pump them, the one to pop them. You know, you want USC to be 8-0 when you play them. And then you beat USC, whoever that team is. If you're Arizona State, if you're UCLA, whoever it is, you want them to be as good as possible.
Yeah, and you want to manage your resources so well that any additional resources can be used to just kick other people's asses, right? If Washington wants to make sure that University of Oregon cashes a bigger check, then University of Oregon uses that check to turn around and kick Washington's ass some more. That's got to be the attitude. That's why you have to root for Washington in those scenarios. Do you think that Amazon likes its competitors? It doesn't like its competitors. It wants to eradicate them all. But guess what? Amazon is the biggest platform, and so they invite everybody to sell things on their platform. And while you're selling something on Amazon's platform, they're studying you, learning about your product, trying to figure out a way to make it cheaper so that they can then sell it directly, thus eradicating the business, right? Everything that Amazon does that even seems like it's a nice thing is actually designed to destroy everything in its path.
They
so
put Toys R Us out of business, dude.
Exactly.
Toys R Us decided to sell on their platform, and then it was over.
Right.
They just went direct to the manufacturers and was like, "Hey, yo, why don't you sell here and just cut out the middleman?" And now Toys R Us, the only person that's going to Toys R Us is 50 Cent when he rents it out for his kid. I didn't even know that there was a Toys R Us left to rent out.
and so that's my thing, is like, you don't even have to, if your whole thing is that I hate Washington so much that I would never root for Washington, then what I would counter with is, then you don't hate Washington enough to root for Washington. Right? Because you can then turn around and use those resources to stick it to them some more. But people don't understand that there are those selfish reasons to back the Pack. Or you could just do it because it's fun and we're all kind of in this together, which is where I'm at. But if you want to take it down that long, dark road, yeah, root for everybody else to be as good as they could be, because the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Perfect example here. One time, so everybody knows who follows me or whatever, I have a blended family. And when I was playing in the league my son's mom was super mad at me about something. She was like, I was still playing in the NFL. Oh, I hope your career is terrible. I was like, do you realize what you're saying right now? If you want me to fail, that takes money out of your pocket. Like, that takes money out of your pocket the worse I do. So you should actually be my biggest fan. If you don't like me, if you're upset with me, you should be my biggest fan, because then you get more money, right? but people's cut off their nose to spite. I mean, like, that's when, you know, like, you won't let common sense get in the way of your argument or your emotions. Like, you just have to do what's in your own self-interest. Revenge, if you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves, one for you and one for the person that you're out to kill. But what Ralph, what does success look like for the Pac-12 in bowl games this year? Because I'm like, the Washington Boise State game to me wasn't very important in terms of the national. It was good to win that game, but I didn't think it would be detrimental to lose that game to a ranked Boise State team versus the USC-Iowa game is important to win. And I think the most important bowl game to win, period, is the Texas-Utah game. I cannot put enough emphasis in my mind about why that's important, because you have Utah, 11-2. People thought could have been a college football playoff team. And then they're playing 7-5 Texas, which I absolutely hate, because bowl games, I feel like, should be matched up better instead of just conference tie-ins. But I digress. I think that game is by far the most important game to the conference, because you can't have the Big 12's third or fourth best team, who's lost 5 games, lose to a team that played in the conference championship and could have been a playoff team, because that makes your team look like it's like your conference almost look like pumped up and inflated, like you didn't really play anybody tough and you were just going to get in just because you had the most wins.
I think that if Oregon, Utah, and USC win, it's gravy. If you can win those three games, then this will have, as weird of a season as it was, without getting anybody in the college football playoff, and with University of Washington somehow having a really good team and managing to, you know, take that really great team to 7-5, but also somehow be completely impervious to the Mountain West stuff. Like, they blew out Hawaii and Boise State in a year where the Mountain West dominated the Pac-12 head-to-head. So what a strange year for Washington. But I feel like for the Pac-12 to be taken seriously, USC's got to beat Iowa, Oregon's got to get a win, and Utah's got to win. It's that simple to me. The ASU-Florida State game means very little to me, because both teams are undergoing massive transitions on their coaching staffs, and neither team will have a running back. So it's not even going to be like a classic football game. You're not actually going to see the two teams as they are constructed go head-to-head. It's just going to be a mess. And so that game doesn't matter to me at all. Cal game doesn't really matter to me at all. You know, they're still without an offensive coordinator, and they already had enough offensive issues. I think you got those three important games, and to me the Washington game was important as well, just with everything that the Mountain West has done to the Pac-12, and with people arguing that Boise State belonged in an even bigger possible New Year's Six bowl. I thought that was really big. And at the same time, knowing that in the Las Vegas Bowl last year, Fresno State beat the crap out of Arizona State. So I think that that was helpful for the Pac-12, but those three games are the ones that matter most.
I just still think that I think that Oregon, Wisconsin is important, because, you know, the Big Ten was perceived as extremely strong this year. You had, you know, Wisconsin, Penn State, Ohio State, all vying for spots in the college football playoff. And then Iowa was extremely strong as well. So when you look at that, you're saying, okay, yes, that's good to get a win. Especially if you're Oregon, not only just for this year, but coming up, you're looking at, oh, hold up, you got Ohio State in the second game of the season next year at home. So you want to put something out in the world that makes that much bigger of a game. That makes this, you know, even bigger, because I actually look at that even bigger than the Auburn-Oregon game last year. And for the conference, I'm just saying what looks like a success for the Pac-12 to me is finishing 5-2 in bowl games at worst, 5-2, because you already got a win in Washington. You need USC, Iowa, and then getting Utah over Texas, Oregon over Wisconsin, and then either Washington State over Air Force, Cal over Illinois, or Arizona State over Florida State. I think that looks like a win. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're more than capable of. I think all the matchups are pretty favorable. I think that they're more than capable of winning out. It's just a matter of will they. You know, again, that Florida State-Arizona State game, it doesn't mean anything to me either way, no matter who wins, because it's a shell coaching staff for Florida State. ASU lost their offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. No Eno Benjamin for ASU, no Cam Akers for Florida State. Kalen Laybourne, the backup running back, very talented backup running back for Florida State, just had surgery, so there will be zero scholarship running backs for Florida State, and Arizona State will be running out there with A.J. Carter, who had like 20 carries this year. So it's and no Brandon Ayuk either. So I guess it'll be kind of a little sneak preview of next year. But the outcome doesn't matter to me that much. Every other game I feel like is winnable and matters, you know, a little bit. But, you know, that USC game, that's huge for Clay Helton, because Clay Helton has no grace right now afforded to him at all. And I'm not sure that a bowl win will earn him any. But they need it because they're still in the thick of recruiting season and they just need any good press.
Well, that leads me to the next point about recruiting, because we saw some signing day surprises. We saw, you know, USC supposedly having four silent recruits that didn't happen. And you have other schools, obviously, in the Pac-12 happy or upset, depending on where players go. Because they're like, ooh, I don't want them to go to my rival. But I'm glad he stayed in the Pac-12. That's the way I look at these things. I'm like, ooh, you wanted him. But I'm glad that he's not a part of that narrative of the mass exodus from the West. All of this. Because I think that, you know, it's one of those things that where you can almost manifest certain things when they're talked about so much. If these recruits are consistently hearing, oh, all the great recruits are leaving the West, all of them are leaving the West, I think that makes it more likely for them to continue to leave, you know, continue to leave SoCal, continue to leave, you know, Oregon or Washington or wherever else. When in reality, if you look at the South, some of the best players from the South leave and go to other conferences. They go to Oklahoma. They go to Texas. They don't stay in their necessary state. But when it comes to the West, this is a narrative. I look at it like that. This is almost like a propaganda push where the SEC, they don't get, you know, that same type of hype when some of their best players leave. But then, you know, you have players staying in the Pac-12 footprint, and all of a sudden it's a mass exodus from the West, even though you did have Bryce Young leave SoCal to go to Alabama. But the question is, where could he have gone? Because he's interested in playing early, the quarterback from Modern Day. But I'm looking at it, okay, if you're looking at a Pac-12 school, where could you have gone to play early? You could have gone to Colorado, but maybe he's interested in winning a national championship or getting close, and they're not close. I mean, you got Utah, but I mean, is that going to put you where you want to be? USC's full right now. I mean, I guess you could have potentially gone to Oregon, but you know, ASU, who's hot right now, they got a quarterback. UCLA, not quite close right now. I mean, where else could the kid have gone? But and then it turns into some big drama thing, and I'm just like, it wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to recognize quarterbacks should be completely separate from this entire equation. Like that, you should look at in-state recruiting and footprint recruiting outside of the quarterback, because the quarterback's looking for the right coach and the right system, and it's going to be very specific to them. Quarterbacks typically come from families that have a little more means, which means they get to travel a little bit more. They're recruited from an even younger age by coaches who sort of bounce around or have more connections. So I don't think you should look at like DJ Uiagalelei or Bryce Young as, you know, losses for the region when every quarterback in Texas is leaving Texas. Almost every quarterback in California is leaving California. Every single quarterback in Arizona, for the most part, leaves Arizona. That's just kind of the cost of doing business. I mean, Jacob Eason left and came back. So I think that if you throw quarterbacks out, it was still kind of a down year, especially when you have, you know, Bijan Robinson going to Texas instead of, you know, he grew up a USC fan. That was a big issue this year, is that you have a lot of people who said they grew up USC fans who, you know, didn't feel like USC could be a place where they played football. Even DJ Uiagalelei came out today and said, like, hey, yeah, I loved USC growing up. They didn't really recruit me, though. One of the reasons that they didn't really recruit him is because they had Bryce Young in the fold, and then Bryce Young leaves them high and dry. So, you know, that's it's going to continue to be a problem. We're sort of more of a global society. You know, any coach can FaceTime any kid at any time. You know, distance doesn't really matter. George, you and I record this podcast from 500-600 miles away from each other. That's just the way that things are now. We're all a little bit more connected. You know, being far from home, it matters less the distance and more the culture. You know, and as cultures sort of blend together, you know, people from out west can really get along anywhere.
Yeah.
They really can, because there's not like too much Western culture. You know, everybody's kind of taking bits and pieces from everywhere else as far as that goes. So I'm not all that worried about it, as long as you can convince good players to come out here as well.
Yeah, and there haven't been a whole lot of five stars who've exited, you know, the South or Midwest to come out West, but you do get some of those four-star athletes that are willing to move and to, you know, kind of to take that chance, because like you said, the culture in the West is a lot more laid back, and you have different, you know, kind of some of those different Southern values, and, you know, there's food. It's funny because there's a food issue, because I noticed this when I went down to play in Jacksonville, is that I ate pretty much everything living in California, pretty much everything, because I was born in Memphis. So we would have soul food at home. Sometimes I ate like traditional real Mexican food, Thai food, Indian food, Chinese food, Japanese food, eat ramen, like real ramen, you know, sukumin, all that. And you're just sitting there like, those things aren't readily available down south, but you can live with comfort food, where people who are used to eating things that are fried hard all the time and coming out to California or coming out west, and they're like, whoa, what the hell is going on out here? It is too big. It is too much going on. And then when they go to, you know, sometimes when they go to the Northwest, they're like, wow, this is way too white for me. And those are the things that you literally have to fight with or battle with when you are recruiting, trying to get kids from down south to leave that environment, especially when a lot of these kids, you know, like when you look at families in general, what is it that people generally don't move further than, don't end up living more than like 50 miles away from their parents or away from where they grew up, that most people don't? So when you think about that, yeah, of course, geography matters. Kids are going to want to stay close. But now with the what you were saying, Ralph, the advent of, you know, FaceTime, you know, planes being so accessible, all of these, like, you know, it makes the distance less, and it makes people more willing to leave. Because I know I got homesick when I was home, and if I had been able to FaceTime my family on a daily basis, multiple times a day, FaceTime my sisters, my mom, my dad, my friends, because I didn't even have a cell phone at that point in time. like it would have made things a lot easier for me. And I probably would have been more willing to go other places.
Yeah. I've sort of lived my whole life in the footprint that I grew up in. I'm from Wyoming. I came up in Arizona, and anytime I'm going to go on vacation, I go back into the mountains of the Northwest and the Mountain West. Like I know what I know. And I remember the first time that my wife took me back home to Pittsburgh with her, I was petrified, you know, and it ended up being a fascinating, awesome experience, but like I knew nothing. There were people everywhere. They walk different. They talk different. You know, I grew up in Arizona where the oldest building out here is like a 20-year-old Walgreens. They had buildings out in Pittsburgh that said like 1565 on the side, you know,
yeah.
Built by stonemasons in the 16th century. And I was just out of my element completely. And I love that. And I love having new experiences with my family and everything. But I know what I know and I'm comfortable there. And most people like to be comfortable. If you're going to be uncomfortable, it takes sort of a concerted effort. And so if you go out on a visit, if you're a recruit and it's to a place that sort of makes you feel challenged and uncomfortable right from the get-go, you got to be of a different makeup and a different mindset, or you have to have been on that track for a while. And I think that that's the biggest difference between like a football player and a basketball player. Basketball players are trained from the very, very, very early age that like, you are never going to be comfortable. You're a 6'7" person in a world built for 5'8" people. You're not going to be comfortable on a plane. You're not going to be comfortable in a car. The environment shouldn't matter to you because you're going to be in a gym somewhere. You know, it doesn't matter what the weather's like. Your teammates are only going to be your teammates for a maximum of 2 or 3 years. You have to form an identity in yourself. It's going to be kind of lonely, but you can do this job anywhere. And club teams travel, and everybody is sort of raised up that way from a really early age. Football players, it's, hey, let's establish our culture right here with people who are similar to you from your neighborhood. The furthest game that we are going to play away from your neighborhood is 100 miles with a bunch of people who probably share your makeup and your culture, you know, and then we're going to lean in real hard to the things that make us comfortable, because identity is a huge part of who we are. So you're just raised up a completely different way. And so if you're traveling to a new city to check out a college and it doesn't vibe with your makeup, you know, there's a lot of kids from New Orleans who fly in to look at the Arizona schools, ASU and U of A. And, you know, they get a lot of kids come here and say, oh man, that was a really good time. I don't think I could do that for 4 years. And then they get some kids who are kind of outcasts back where they're from say like, yeah, I have no problem doing this. But it's always interesting to kind of see how recruiting works out for football players, because so much of football at the high school level is about comfort and culture, you know, whereas basketball, it's about like, hey, you are always going to be uncomfortable. You should be ready to go anywhere, play anywhere at any time.
Yeah. And in basketball, which some of football is transitioning to now, is they just literally, I mean, they hop schools, hop teams, hop states, like so easily. My cousin a couple years ago was one of the top players in Ohio. He moved down to Florida to go to Mount Verde, just because it was a better opportunity for him playing against better competition.
I know that's a point you brought up before, George. That's why so many of these colleges are bringing in assistant coaches who are familiar with those cultures and those places, so that they have somebody to relate to when they get on campus, or they feel like they have some connective tissue to where they're from.
Yeah, assistant coaches have more power now than they ever have. You know, it was always the head coaches, you know, like, oh, we got to keep our head coach, But now when you see even coaches change over, like you saw Chris Peterson and Jimmy Lake, and you've seen it happen in other places where they keep recruiting classes together because assistants stay. Because yes, the head coach closes it, but at the end of the day, now in 2019, the assistant coaches matter. We saw Johnny Wilson flip from Oregon because a GA left. I mean, literally an analyst who was not a coach, a real coach on staff, left, and then the offensive coordinator took the head coaching job at UNLV. And even though they had a wonderful recruiting class, kids he knew, all of that stuff, he was like, "Nah, I'm gonna go down to ASU." Like, that's how important those relationships are. And sometimes, and I think coaches, they realize that, and that's why we talked about on the other podcast, the last podcast about recruiting, about how it's not necessarily all about the greatest coaches, because coaches know that they can overcome that players who are great players can make you look like a great coach, even if you are not. And then the schools also, they hire people to coach, and then they hire people to recruit. And sometimes those people take roles like GA, graduate assistant, analyst, or some other special assistant to the coach, or whatever, some non-football coach that they are allowed to have on staff. And that's their whole job, is to recruit.
Right. Nobody ever accused Dennis Erickson of being like a genius in the playbook. But when he got those Miami players down there, when he got that head coaching job out in Miami, won 2 championships and was able to parlay that into several Pac-10, Pac-12 coaching jobs, 2 different stints in the NFL. You know, yeah. It's amazing what some good players will do for your reputation and for your longevity.
I mean, look at Arizona State. You look at, and they have a new defensive coordinator in Tony White, who was their DB coach, their defensive back coach, because their defensive coordinator took the New Mexico job. And you're sitting here and everybody's like, okay, I think it's going to be Antonio Pierce. Because when you look at Arizona State's recruiting, you see Antonio Pierce. You don't see anybody else nearly as much as you see him. He's in all the kids' edits. He's, you know, Mr. Steel, your recruit, whatever it else is. Like, he is.
He's like if you remember when Suge Knight got up on stage and said, like, "You want to come to Death Row Records? You don't have your producer dancing all in your videos."
Yep.
Remember that? Yeah. Antonio Pierce is like if Suge Knight was Puffy.
Yes, he's Puffy. And
like, he looks like Suge, acts like Puffy. And yeah, he's got his fingerprints all over this recruiting class.
And that's why I think a lot of people expected him to be defensive coordinator. But from everything that I know about Antonio Pierce, is Antonio Pierce would rather be a head coach than a coordinator, because he's like Jerry Maguire. He's great in the living room, and I think that he wants to be CEO of a team and not coordinator of a team, because it is a different skill set. And I think it's important to recognize what you want in life and what you're good at in life. Because if Antonio Pierce believes that he's not either capable or to be as great as he wants to be as coordinating compared to being a head coach, because I do think he's going to be a good head coach when he gets the opportunity, provided he hires some good coordinators. But maybe it's smart on him to know that being the coordinator is not necessarily the best move for him and his career and his future success, because Tony White being named defensive coordinator brought a shock to me, because I was like, oh, wow, what are they now going to do with Antonio Pierce? But then read further down, Antonio Pierce is promoted to assistant head coach. And I was like, ah, bingo. That's where that's at, because I don't think he has any desire to be head coach. I mean, to be defensive coordinator, Ralph.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. He's doing a good job at what he's doing right now. He gets a bump in pay to keep doing that exact thing. You know, he didn't fall into the trap of the Peter principle. And that's what you like to see, people who are self-aware, who know their strengths. And that's real big, right? Like, and if he is angling to eventually be a head coach somewhere, then this will probably prepare him more, taking more ownership without getting bogged down in sort of the minutia of game planning will probably put him more on that track.
Yeah. If he can just stay connected to the players, learn how to be even closer with Herm with the head coaching stuff, stay connected to the players, stay connected to the bigger picture and fully understand how everything works even more, and plan his own life out, then I think that's the move, because to me, it looks like Herm is enjoying coaching, that he is enjoying everything that he's doing. But, you know, he is an old man. So this could only be another 2, 3, 4 years to where he's putting these other coaches that he brought in, everybody from Kevin Mawai to Cincinnati's old coach, Marvin Lewis, and some of these other people in positions to move up in their career, advance their career. And I think that eventually in a few years, Herm's just going to be like, all right, I'm done. I've done my good job, elevated the program, put it in a good position, and now it's your turn to take over, guys.
Right. And, you know, I know that down in University of Arizona, they were kind of like hoping that they'd throw some cash at Antonio Pierce to bring him down there to run the defense. Didn't work out that way. I tell you what, if Antonio Pierce does end up getting a head coaching job at Arizona State, it's going to drive Arizona Wildcats absolutely nuts, because, you know, he's part of that Desert Swarm defense down there. They really don't like seeing him in maroon and gold. But, you know, he's also one of those guys that played, like, what, 1 year of college football after leaving JUCO. That was just kind of a pit stop for him. I'm not sure he's too wrapped up in that.
Yeah, but what if Antonio Pierce, I mean, if things don't go well for Arizona this year with Kevin Sumlin, he could be a guy who could be on Arizona's shortlist.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? I mean, and that would be, you know, that would be really, really good for him. And that'd be a great way to kind of reconcile their relationship. But what University of Arizona is hoping, and what Kevin Sumlin's hoping, is that the hire they did make for defensive coordinator actually ends up making the difference and staves that possibility off for a couple more years. And that's Paul Rhodes, former Iowa State head coach, who was serving in a capacity of defensive back coach at UCLA. He's going to come down to University of Arizona, and they're going to see if they can right the ship. They're going to move away from the 3-3-5 defense and have some multiple fronts. And what they're really hoping is it gives them a crack at 4-star defensive end Jason Harris, because that's, you know, that's who they had their eye on. And I think losing him to Colorado or Indiana would be incredibly embarrassing for them, considering that their dad, Sean Harris, is one of the better players in U of A history. And then also, you know, his brother Jalen is currently on the defensive line, probably the best player on their defense down there. They announced that, and then they announced that they got Brennan Schooler, right? They announce him as a transfer, and slowly but surely they're going to try to build this defense up under Paul Rhodes. It should be really interesting.
I am, like, when you look at Paul Rhodes' history and you look at all the places that he has been, obviously he was Iowa State's head coach. He's been at, you know, a GA at Ohio State. He's been at the defensive coordinator at Pittsburgh when they had some good years. Auburn's defensive coordinator. Been at Arkansas, UCLA. And I'm just speculating. So there have been some years that he's had some good defenses, some defenses that have just been iffy. And when you look at, you know, UCLA's defensive performances in the back end last year, yes, part of it could be about scheme. Yes, part of it could be, I mean, it could be anything. However, I just, you know, like, you typically only see these hires from people who came from, you know, having good defenses the previous year, because UCLA's pass defense this year in 2019 was dead last in the Pac-12. They allowed 66% completion percentage, which was worse than the Pac-12. They gave up 3,700 yards, 32 touchdowns, and 310 yards a game, which was worse than the Pac-12. So, pardon me for being a little bit skeptical of what's going to happen at University of Arizona.
Well, let's be fair to UCLA. They only had, you know, multiple top 10 recruiting classes to deal with. So,
dude,
you know, it's,
I
not,
mean,
sheesh.
Isn't that weird though, that the narrative was that the cupboard was yes. bare when Chip got there. But when you look at the rankings, I mean, this is either a case of Jim Mora was only recruiting off paper and not developing players, just recruiting off stars, because none of those guys translated into top tier players. It was weird. They had these really good recruiting classes, but then when Chip got there, the cupboard was bare. I found that odd.
Yeah, I mean, nobody should be saying that the cupboard was bare because highly regarded players didn't develop the way that they should have there. That's, you know, that's a really weird way of looking at it. I'm out here. There's a college called Grand Canyon University. They got a really good basketball team, and they built a brand new stadium for them, and they had to gut it about 3 years in to add 3,000 more seats just because of, you know, the excitement that was going on. But, you know, that it kind of reminded me of UCLA football, of like Chip Kelly going in there cutting players and, you know, tearing things up. Like, no, it was nice before. Like, it was nice and new before. So this is a remodel, not a rebuild. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise, that the cupboard was empty and that they're having a, you know, that they're building in the middle of an empty field or something. They had good players. He just didn't come in right away and find a way to use the players that were on the team to the best of their ability. And you can turn around, you can blame Jim Mora Jr. for a little bit of that and the mindset that team had when he left. But, you know, he cut and gutted a lot of this team himself. Those are choices that he was making to do things his way. And that's who you hired. That's what you ask for when you bring in a guy like Chip Kelly. So you can't really complain too much. I do have a question for you, though. Since you're not completely sold on Dorian Thompson-Robinson, and we now have two different quarterbacks who are going to be in the transfer portal from Pac-12 schools, do you think that UCLA would be a good landing spot for either Joey Yellen or KJ Costello? And if not UCLA, where might be a good spot?
Okay, so KJ Costello, he'll leave Stanford. And I thought that he was going to have a really good year this year. I thought that he was going to have an opportunity to throw the ball more. I thought David Shaw was going to let him pitch it around. Started out okay, I guess. Then he was hurt all year long. I mean, I don't think that either one of those spots is a good spot for I don't think that UCLA is a good spot for KJ Costello. I actually think that Arizona would be a better spot for KJ Costello. Because Costello has experience running an offense. He has experience doing all of these things that you need to do. He's won games. He's played in big games. Like, there's so much to like about Costello, especially as a stopgap or a bridge, because it was clear this year that Grant Gunnell either wasn't ready or Kevin Sumlin and the staff did a poor job of putting him in good positions to be successful, because they kept switching him and Khalil Tate out like all year long. So you have to say, all right, where should he go? If you're KJ Costello, you should go to either Arizona or you should go to Colorado, because Colorado's leaving a four-year star, or even Utah. They're all wide open, you know, kind of three, four-year starters at all the places. And now they're gone, so nobody else really has any experience or has a leg up.
Yeah.
And it's not like they brought in some hot shot recruit at any of those positions that they expect to come in and play immediately.
Well, I really like Colorado as a potential landing spot for Joey Yellen. I think he'd be really great there. Grew up a Peyton Manning fan. It'd be kind of cool for him to head out there. But answer me this. One, did Jacob Eason do enough in the Las Vegas Bowl to entertain the idea of going pro? And two, if he does, could you see KJ Costello stepping into the mix at Washington?
Real quick on Joey Yellen, though. I don't think that it's weird because, yes, he had a good showing in that one game against Arizona State, but at the same time, I understand why he's transferring. It makes complete sense. But
yeah,
I mean, because you're playing behind Jaden Daniels, who's not coming out. Like that, unless he decides in the offseason that he's going to smoke and drink himself out of a potential NFL career, it's not happening. Like you're gonna need to pray for an injury, pray for something, you know, tragic to happen in his life, and any of those things, he'll probably bounce back from anyway. So if I'm yelling, I agree with you. I try Arizona, Colorado, Utah, maybe even Washington. But to answer your question about Eason, though, Eason wasn't spectacular in the bowl game. He was 22 for 23. 210 yards and a touchdown. I mean, when you look at his season long numbers, he finished in the Pac-12. He was number, let me pull it up super quick. He finished the season seventh in passing. He was 238 for 330 for 373 with 8 touchdowns and 8 interceptions, 22 touchdowns, 243 yards a game. He was okay, I guess. He was 8th in the conference in passing efficiency. 8th in the conference. The people who were buff him, Tyler Huntley, Slovis, Herbert, Gordon, Daniels, Luton, and Davis Mills at Stanford. And I'm just like, I mean, he was right above Dorian Thompson-Robinson. Like, yes, he looks the part. He looks the part. Jacob Eason looks the part. But if you have another year of eligibility and you have been doing what he has been doing, I'm sitting there just like, all right, yes, you had a decent year, but you're just going to be going off speculation. And unless you can speculate that you're a top 10 pick, which I don't think he's going to be, you put yourself in a situation to where, you know, like you're putting your NFL career and money at risk as opposed to coming back and changing some of those oh no moments into, all right, okay, this kid looks legit now.
You know what's interesting about Jacob Eason is this year was probably better than three of Jake Browning's 4 years at quarterback. But that means that in the last 5 years, Washington has had just above average quarterback play, like not even good quarterback play. Because Jake Browning, as a freshman, had 16 touchdowns, 10 interceptions. As a junior, 19 touchdowns, 5 interceptions. And as a senior, 16 touchdowns, 10 interceptions. Jacob Eason had 23-8 this year. Only Jake Browning's sophomore year, where he had 43 touchdown passes, and most of those came in the first 6 games of the season against subpar competition before people kind of caught on to what he was doing. You know, it really hasn't been great quarterback play for the University of Washington. But do you think it'll speed up Jacob Eason's decision, knowing that he's going to have to get used to a new offensive coordinator next year?
Yes. I think that leans more to him leaving, but it depends on who that offensive coordinator is. If that guy is a proven quarterback developer, then I think he may stay because he may see the writing on the wall and say, hold up, I do need to get it to get better. So I think that's probably where his head is at. He's like, all right, let me get a little bit better. Let me improve my draft stock, my draft status. Because I was talking to my son about this today. He asked me, how do players know or when is it the right time to come out and go to the NFL or the NBA? I said, you don't go when you think you're going to get drafted high. You go when you're ready. Because if you're not ready, yes, you can be drafted highly, but you've cut your career short and cut off your back end money, which actually where the real money is on that second contract. So if you can stay in school for an extra year because you need it to develop to give yourself career longevity, then that's actually the optimal move. Because is it optimal to play 4 years, make make $30 million as a top 10 pick and be labeled as a bust? Or is it better to stay in school, either still be a top 10 pick or be a top 20 pick, and then have a 15-year career, half of it as a starter, half of it as a backup, and make $80 million?
True. Now, let's talk about Bush Hamdan for a second, because it feels a little bit extra savage when it's your coworker who gives you the boot. Because, you know, Chris Peterson was there, and then Chris Peterson moves on. The first day of the Jimmy Lake administration, he fires what was his offensive counterpart. I don't know. To me, that just feels a little bit more cold-blooded. Like, or maybe it's the move you have to make. Step in there, establish your kingdom, leave absolutely no question that you're the one in the driver's seat.
I think that move was coming no matter who was the coordinator. I mean, no matter who was the head coach. If Chris Peterson was the head coach, Hamdan was getting fired. If Jimmy Lake's the head coach, he was gone. I mean, Washington's offense has not been good, really. Since Jonathan Smith. I mean,
so now there's three open coordinator positions. What do you do? Like, who's getting who?
Oh, everybody is fighting for. I mean, so originally everybody was fighting for Zach Hill from Boise State, which may have been a reason why Boise State didn't play out that well versus Washington.
Yeah, I tweeted that last night. Boise State looks like they could use some offensive coordination.
Right, exactly. So Arizona State stole Boise State's coordinator. And then you have Rhett Lashley at SMU. Yeah. Who could have definitely used a good offensive performance, but they got absolutely boat raced by FAU, which was just horrendous. And, you know, if you're sitting there and he's sitting there, had people knocking down his door, I know that there are some calls that probably didn't come after that game. Granted, a lot of that was on his players. They made some really poor throws. They fumbled. They did all kind of stuff. So it wasn't all him. But it just looks bad when you get housed, you know, and you're up for offensive coordinator jobs. But the hot name around is Chris Long from former Notre Dame offensive coordinator. And he got the boot after averaging 37 points per game. 37 points per game. One of the nation's more top offenses in terms of scoring. And he got the boot. So I had to do some asking around, some digging, right? Because I'm like, how does this guy get fired? Especially everything that you hear on the recruiting circuit is that this dude is a high-level master recruiter, okay? Master recruiter, that he is one of those guys that you hire and is able to, that he's part of the orchestration of a couple West Coast kids, top West Coast kids going to Notre Dame. And I know this for a fact. And here is what I asked. I asked a question to a couple of people who will remain anonymous. What do you think of Chip Long? I didn't mean Chris. I called him Chris Long earlier. I meant Chip Long. What do you think of Chip Long? I heard he's a good recruiter. I also heard players don't like him. But that didn't really make sense to me. How could both be true? Here's the quote. I'm biased, but I'll tell you the full scope. We had a close relationship, and he's the one who brought me to Notre Dame, elite football mind. And he's one of the few coaches that makes sure your life outside of football is going well. The only issue is people in the program didn't like the way that he would yell at players. Someone like me, yelling isn't an issue. Others were strongly affected by his style. I love him, though, and I'm bummed he's no longer with us.
I tell you that I'm not surprised by that quote. And he was somebody who was a recruiting coordinator and tight ends coach at Arizona State before leaving with Mike Norvell to go to Memphis. And and here are a couple of things that were told to me while he was here. Incredible recruiter, going to be a head coach someday. Why is everybody named Chip a jerk? So, I mean, one of the nicest people I've ever met in my entire life. Not even just nicest. I wouldn't say that they're nice. I would say that, like, one of the best human beings I've ever met in my life, who's still kind of a pretty intense person, loves on everybody, super charitable. Even he was like, man, I don't know if I can do Chip Long. Like, that's a lot. Like, that dude is a lot.
Wow. See, here's the good news is this, is look at a guy like Coach Ogeron.
Yeah.
Look at Bill Belichick. Look at Pete Carroll. Guys who got jobs. I mean, and the list goes on and on and on. Guys who got jobs, and the first time they thought that they had to do things one way, and then they get fired, and then that changes their approach with how they do it. But then sometimes you get guys like Tom Coughlin who won't change. That's why he's fired in Jacksonville right now. But I think that is a big thing. So hopefully, whatever the things were that got Chip Long fired, in terms of, you know, how to deal with the players in terms of football wise, because you don't have to yell to be effective. Like, that's it. Like, you don't always have to yell, cuss people out and all that stuff, because it can't just be yelling. It's got to be some not cool things that are being said. So he's either going to have to change his style, because there's no way he'll be a head coach if that's the style he uses with players. Because you have to get the players. But it's weird because the players say that he's a great recruiter and he checks on them as a people person. So he probably feels like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You're like, this dude is one way half the time, but then some of the other time, what the hell is he doing?
Or the dude's just going 11 out of 10 and everything. Like, maybe that's it. Like, maybe he just goes hard as a recruiter, hard as a friend, hard as a coach, you know, and one of those grates on you, because in only one of those is he in a position of authority. So, yeah. You know, who knows? But I just, all I know is only one team can end up with him. And if you're patient, you know, you might end up with Jason Garrett on the market, because that dude's for sure getting fired.
Dude, but hold on. The Jason Garrett still has a shot, dude. Because this is where Jason Garrett is just like Clay Helton. They make it so difficult to fire them every single year. So the Cowboys lost to the Eagles. So they're 7-8. Eagles are 8-7. But next week, I think the Eagles play the Giants and the Cowboys play the Redskins. So if the Cowboys win and Eagles lose, the Cowboys go to the playoffs. So it's one of those things, Ralph, that if you just look, like, that's probably what's going to happen. And then Jason Garrett's going to go win a playoff game or two, get to the NFC Championship, and then lose on a controversial call. And then everybody's going to be like, how do you fire the guy now?
Right.
And that is Chip, and that is Clay Helton too. They are the same guy. But if things don't go right, then you are right. Jason Garrett may be in the offensive coordinator business. But I think that's where rivalries are even stronger, because you got Washington, Oregon. Who else is looking for a coordinator?
Isn't Cal still on the market? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All looking for coordinators. And you have to think that Cal is probably not as attractive as Washington and Oregon because the paycheck won't be as big. So you're like, So now you got Washington and Oregon, who clearly hate each other, fighting for the same coach. That should go over well. That should go over real, real well. I wanted to, before we get out of here today, though, I want to hit on the recruiting classes slightly a bit. What was your biggest surprises from National Signing Day?
I was pretty surprised by zero drama from Brendan Rice. He just went in there and inked his signature with Colorado and said, let's do this. That rounded out what to me was a really good class for Colorado. And I haven't read it yet, but I did see that somebody wrote a piece for The Athletic on just how good this recruiting class could be for Colorado. So I'm excited to sit down and maybe read that this evening. But Brendan Rice, I know, was kind of waffling a little bit. There weren't too many out and out surprises for me. Utah, though, didn't Utah land like Clark Phillips? And that one was out of nowhere. I didn't even have that.
They got him from Ohio State, right?
Yeah, that was not even on my radar. He is somebody that I think is maybe rated I wonder if he's a little bit higher on 24/7 than he is on Rivals, but he's a very good player. Like, he's a play now player, and that was huge for Utah to get somebody who could probably step in and do some damage right away in the defensive backfield, especially if we're assuming that Jalen Johnson is done, and they're going to need some help. They're going to be young, and they have no problem if you're ready, you know. And Rivals has him as the number 63 player in the entire country, which would rank him. Let's see where that ranks him just amongst overall Pac-12 recruits. Let's see. The highest recruit that anybody landed in the Pac-12 was Justin Flo, which is pretty obvious. According to Rivals, he's the number 4 player in the country. From that point, Savelle Smalls comes in at number 13 to Washington. Noah Sewell at number 16 to Oregon. And then, I mean, as far as the top 25 goes, that's it. That's all that stayed with Pac-12 schools. And then I think from that point, you drop down the list pretty far before you have anybody else who signed with a Pac-12 school. And actually, it is. It's Clark Phillips. He's the 4th highest rated prospect in the entire Pac-12, according to Rivals, to sign and announce. That's a very important part, and announce with a Pac-12 school. That's huge for Utah. So to me, that's far the biggest surprise.
Yeah, I definitely that was a huge move. I went when I first started hearing buzz about it a day or two before signing day. I was like, yeah, Ohio State, they put out DBs every year. Like, I was surprised, but I was very, very surprised by that move. The other thing that I would say that I was surprised by was Arizona State's recruiting class. I was surprised. I mean, granted, I do agree that we have to give a lot of credit to Colorado because they put together a really good class. They're on 24/7. They're 36th ranked. They still got 3 spots open potentially. But Arizona State sitting at 37 with only 15 signees so far, commit/signees. And I'm looking, and I expect them to close strong. Because there's a couple players who, if you read anything, you know, there's a lot of people who think that when they announce at their bowl games that they're going to get Elijah Badger, the kid Nada out of Folsom 2, and LV Bunkley Shelton, the wide receiver. So you're looking at their class with their 15 recruits and just adding a 5-star, because I think Nada's a 5-star, right?
If he is, it's on 24/7 on Rivals. I don't think even in the top 100, but he's definitely a 4-star.
Yeah. So adding 3 more 4-star players is going to have them with a really good close. I mean, in addition to everything else, how many spots do they have open?
5. I mean, they got some blue shirts. Jack Jones technically wasn't even on scholarship last year, so that they're going to have some. They're going to have some blue shirts, and then a couple of their signees this year are going to be blue shirts for next year. So they got 5 spots. They're probably looking to get some ready-made offensive linemen. There's some rumors out there that, you know, they're looking at some people from A&M, from Stanford. Yeah. I think everybody's looking at some people from Stanford, but I think that, you know, they're trying to get somebody who can come in and play right away on the offensive line. But you're right. I mean, they're expected to close out on three different four-star offensive weapons to go along with what they already have. And I think that we're just getting further and further away from the initial reaction to the Herm Edwards hire, which was universally, and I don't use this lightly at all, universally panned and mocked. I didn't go so far as to come out and say that it was bad or make fun of it or anything like that. But I did write a pretty lengthy piece at the time saying, like, in order for this to work, a lot of things are going to have to sort of fall in line. And it seems like things are sort of starting to go that way. I mean, let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is still a team that won seven games, you know, between seven and eight games 3 years in a row. So, you know, seven wins last year, seven wins this year under Herm Edwards with a shot at an eighth win in a bowl game. So nobody should be saying like coach of the year or anything like that, but it's not the worst thing that ever happened, which that was the prediction from everybody, was that this was just an enormous joke of a hire.
And I was in the same boat as you, Ralph. I was just like, this is going to be 100% feast or famine. Like there's no in between. Like this is either going to be a disaster of a hire, or this is going to be really, really good for building a program. I didn't think there was any in between when it came to that. I was also surprised with Utah. Obviously, like we said with Clark, them getting Clark and then finishing super strong, that was amazing. But they only have 17 spots and a lot of room left too. What do you think about their class?
It's a good class. I mean, they've got a lot of room for people to come in and help right away. And that, you know, up until very recently, I think I've brought this up on the podcast again and again and again, they didn't even have anybody from a state that has a Pac-12 school in it, right? But they closed out really strong in state. They got four players from the state of Utah, which is really, really good for them, because that usually means that they're running up against BYU for some of those players. So to beat out BYU is a really, really big deal. They got the guys that they got from Texas, but they also established a presence in California, which I thought was very important, especially with the Clark Phillips thing. Like, again, so they've got more than one four-star because they got Van Fillinger out of Draper, Utah. And both of those guys could probably come in and make an immediate impact. Clark Phillips is going to have to put some weight on, but I mean, he's a real legit player, and for him to flip from Ohio State, that's huge. And it was really funny to see Utah fans trolling Ohio State fans, you know, who Ohio State fans could bleed 8 4 stars and still have a top 20 recruiting class. But it was fun to see Utah fans being able to get on Ohio State fans' nerves on signing day. Like, Utah Twitter just has this unique way of getting under people's skin. And I thought that was pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Ralph. I think that Utah finished strong. I thought UCLA did as well, that they put themselves in a really good position. They even got a quarterback who can possibly compete with Dorian Thompson-Robinson, and then the kid who transferred from Washington is going to be eligible this upcoming year. The kid is Parker McQuire, this kid from New Hampshire, ironically, which leads me to believe that the kid is underrated and could be really good, because Chip Kelly is from New Hampshire, so he's got ties there. So it's weird to pull a kid from New Hampshire to play football. But I think that could be a sneaky good recruiting class.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, Rivals loves that kid. Rivals has him as the number 9 pro style quarterback in the country. So they think very highly of him. He's huge. He's 6'7". You'll have to help me out with this because you watch a lot more UCLA than me. Do they play a 3-4 or something? Because they have like 7 kids that you could probably call linebackers, or maybe like stand up rush ends. One third of their class is linebackers.
Yeah. I think the goal is to be a three, four. They were set up more like their roster was more constructed to be a 4-3, but I think they've been slowly, you know, over the last two classes, trying to get players to fit that system, you know, because that's what, you know, Oregon played when Chip was there, a version of a 3-4, you know, or either that, or they're going to be more of a 3-3-5 team. So that's their actual goal.
Yeah, well, you can also tell that one of their goals is to just be tall and long, because 21 out of 23 of their commitments are at least 6'1", and 17 out of 23 are at least 6'2". So this is going to be a tall-ass team. If they got that weight program going, then a couple of years from now, these guys are going to look like monsters.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But I am interested to see, and I know we'll talk about it soon, the rest of the class, though, because there are a bunch of really good players out there that the Pac-12 could close on. I mean, everybody is wondering, because you have people that at Oregon that think that your video with Keely Ringo in the Oregon shirt, after he's just been, you know, so secretive and G14 classified about his recruiting, would slip up and wear an Oregon shirt. I don't know. I don't know about that.
Keely Ringo comes in to watch his teammates sign at Saguaro High School. And I've known Keely a long time. And I just say, like, hey, man, you want to talk a little bit about your teammates? Because he knows, like, I know he doesn't want to talk about his recruitment. And so, you know, I'm not going to ask him to do anything that he doesn't want to do. And he's like, of course I'll talk about my teammates. So I tape a 2-minute video with him talking about, you know, his quarterback who's going to Bucknell, his defensive backfield mate who's going to Washington, Jacoby Covington, Damian Sellers, who was on the defense with, who's going to UCLA. Who did like a hat reveal. We talk about all those guys, and I upload the video and I realize, like, this dude's in an Oregon long sleeve shirt the entire time. And my mentions were just an absolute mess after that, because it's signing day. He's wearing an Oregon shirt, but he says he didn't sign anywhere yet. And it's really between Oregon and Georgia. Georgia had to feel pretty good about things heading into the day. And so, yeah, that was pretty messy. His mom's got like a University of Oregon avatar, which also, I guess his mom held like a live python or something like that in a photo shoot for, I want to say it was University of Georgia, and the NCAA came in and said no more posing with live animals. So Keely Ringo's mom got NCAA rules changed, which is a fun little tidbit. But yeah, so I don't know if he's going to Oregon or Georgia. I've thought Georgia since, God, for 5 months. And I think I even, you know, I made a public prediction saying that he'd go to Georgia, and I don't feel like changing it, because you know how I am. If I make the prediction, I'm just going to stand by it. Even if I get new information, you know, I'll go down with the ship. I do know that he was in contact with Justin Flo before Justin Flo announced his commitment to Oregon. You know, those two were talking, and Justin Flo let him know ahead of time. I know that for sure. So,
yeah.
You know, maybe that's a good sign for Oregon fans, but it'll be really interesting when this whole thing gets revealed.
How about Gary Bryant Jr.?
I feel like he's got I think that he sees that he could go to USC in what is a down year for skill positions in that class and really be the shining star of the class.
Yeah, but they still have a lot of players at that position.
They do have a lot of players at that position, but at the end of next year, most of those guys will be gone. So,
yeah.
And you know, Gary Bryant doesn't think – you really think Gary Bryant thinks he can't go in there and be better than some of those dudes? And I'll tell you right now, like, he's not Amon-Ra St. Brown, but
– yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, you're not going to take Amon-Ra St. Brown or Tyler Vaughn's spot if Vaughn stays. Like you're not. Like, you're going to be competing with the Drake kid at – I think it's Drake, right?
London, yeah, 6'5", monstrous wide receiver.
Yeah, so you're going to be fighting with Drake London for catches and anybody else that they have in that room, but you won't be one of the top two guys.
I think that Gary Bryant probably in his mind thinks, all right, well, I'm gonna come there. I'm your punt returner. I'm your kick returner. I'm gonna get some reps on the field. You know, I don't think he's worried about anything. So in my mind, he's a USC lean. I can tell you that, you know, ASU fought real hard to get his attention, and I don't think that he's going to end up going to ASU. But so in my head, I think he'll announce for USC.
Yeah, the recruiting, we will get to all of that in the coming weeks. And we appreciate your time, appreciate your energy. Thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles Podcast. Make sure you guys share it with a friend. Any questions, comments, anything, send it to imad@unafraidshow.com. Peace out. Catch you guys later.
Merry Christmas.